إني ألقى الإناس في صومي وصلاتي ودعائي للرحمن وجميع الطاعات.
What has got to be? I mean, if someone's got a belief system, right? Mm-hmm. Would you agree with me, like, because it seems like this is what you're saying anyways, that that person really ought to have reasons, rationale for what, for believing in what they believe in?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you should definitely have a reason. You shouldn't just believe because, like, other people around you believe. Like, you don't follow the herd. So, yeah, like I said, I think it's good that, like, people challenge that, and it doesn't necessarily have to change your mind, and doesn't, you don't even have to have a counter-argument, but if you believe for a certain reason, if that's reason enough for you, then I think that's fine.
Can I be honest with you? Yeah. Do you know what, like, in the West, in the Western Hemisphere, I'm born up here, yeah? I spent the majority of my adult life and my childhood in this country, yeah? What I've found is that there's sort of like a new culture now, yeah? So, you know, the 2001 UK census said that there were 74% Christians. And if you look at 2011, it went down to 54. So that's a 20% depreciation in 10 years.
Yeah.
That means literally millions of people left Christianity and became atheists, right? I genuinely do believe that those 54% that do claim to be Christian, might not be practicing Christian, or might just put that in the census because they feel like they associate with it to some extent, but they're not practicing it.
Yeah.
So I think it's moving in the direction where the predominant ontology that people have is really like an atheistic one.
Yeah, or agnostic, possibly.
Yeah, or agnostic, right. Yeah. Which is where you're coming from.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you, so what is your rationale? Because we talked about rationale. So what is your rationale for being, what would you call, you could call yourself an agnostic?
I'd say agnostic.
Agnostic is when you don't believe in a certain thing, but when you, you know, you're not against anything either, so you're open to everything, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, like, to me, it's, like, it's, so there's no definitive proof that there is a God.
Yes.
We all know that. Like, and you can believe in that. And you can believe that there is. You have reason that there is. You have the books. It's all fine.
Yeah.
However, I think atheists also have no definitive proof that there's no God. And that's why I'm thinking, why I'm more agnostic than atheist, I think. Because personally, I just, like I said, I try to, like, I feel the live and let live argument's pretty good. Just, like, I'm fine with whatever you believe, as long as you believe, practice it peacefully, as long as you do, can argue about it and don't shove it down my throat, essentially.
Absolutely.
So that's where I think, that's why I reason for agnostic, because I don't necessarily believe that there is a God, but I don't have any proof that there's not. So I just try to live my life as positively as possible, and I feel like that mostly forms
I think this opinion that you have, I genuinely believe that this opinion that you have is probably, if not today, but in the very near future, will be the kind of majority opinion in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah.
I think certainly what you talked about with the live and let live aspect of what you said is no doubt a big part of the Western narrative, because it's liberalism. It's really liberalism in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Right? Or, because that is exactly the Hahn principle, which is espoused by John Stuart Mill on liberty, which is a very important principle that people take. And we'll get to that in a second, but I was going to really ask you another question before we get to that. The question I wanted to ask you was, you touched upon a very interesting point that atheists are adamant, or especially positive atheists, they're adamant that God doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And theists are people who are adamant that God does exist.
Yeah.
And your position is that God, as a theological construct, can't be proven, right?
Yeah.
I'll say to you that, look, first of all, if you look at, I come from like sort of an Islamic background. I'm a Muslim, yeah?
I could have guessed, yeah.
We actually saw you guys all, when you guys
prayed. Yeah, we were praying, yeah, that's right. So that's what we do 5 times a day. If you look at the Quran, this is a book that we believe is the word of God, you'll find that God is described in a certain way, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the biblical discourse, God is described in a certain other way, you could say. There are many similarities,
yeah.
But, you know, there are differences as well, yeah? In the Hindu discourse, there's a third way that God is described, polytheistically, maybe,
yeah.
Or in a pantheistic format. In a Sikh way, there's a, you know, so every religion has its own way of defining what God is.
They all have their own God, but it's just different, right? Like, different.
That's right. So, yeah. What I was going to say is that I cannot stand here as a theist and say that all of the attributes that the Quran talks about as it relates to God are deducible rationally and logically.
Mm-hmm.
Because that would be, I think, a speculative claim. And in fact, we're not asked to do that. We're not asked to believe in that.
No.
In other words, we believe that God is Ar-Rahim, which means the most gracious. Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim, the most gracious, the most merciful. Al-Hakim, the most wise. Al-Wadud, the most loving. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to ask me, have you got a rational or deductible way of finding out that God is loving? I'll say, actually, I don't. And I don't think anyone can do that.
No.
Right?
Yeah.
The reason why we believe that God is loving and because X, Y, Z, our rationality is because it is mentioned in the Quran. And the Quran, we believe, has its own internal mechanism, yeah, for deciphering for us, basically, who God is. Yeah. So, in other words, the author of the Quran, we believe, is God. And it offers evidence to prove this. And thus, when this Quran tells us that God is X, Y, Z, we have reason to believe. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
That's the rationality we're coming from.
Yeah.
Now, however, having said that, there are some of the attributes of what we would call God, but other people can call him other things. I mean, they do, right?
Yeah.
God is an English word that comes from a German root, gut.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an etymological thing. We don't need to refer to that word. But God, i.e. the intelligent force, or the intelligence, or the knowledgeable entity, thing, we could say, that created the universe, I think there are some definite ways to deductively prove that. Can you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
So, I can't say that all of the attributes are rationalizable, but some of the attributes are.
Yeah.
And so my question to you would be like, so for example, if you look at what came before the universe, yeah?
Yeah.
And you might have heard this argument before, but I just want your opinion, man. What happened before the universe, before the singularity, in your opinion?
Yeah, that is a very good question, because it's a question that, at least for me personally, it's a question I always used to ask my parents. Like, what came before that? What came before that? What came before that? Until the very beginning of time, where you have like the Big Bang and stuff like that. And what came before that is very difficult to say. And that's for me, that is also where my like non-atheist, more agnostic side comes in. That yes, there could very well be something before that. Something has to have created everything.
Okay, let's use the word thing or entity because it's completely unbiased. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's not use the word God.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Because that would be a superimposition and it would be unfair to the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's say the thing that came before the universe.
Yeah.
What kind of qualities or attributes must this thing have had in order for the universe to come about?
The universe, the solar system is heliocentric. The sun is in the middle. So the Earth.
That is a very, very good question.
It's not only going around.
I think it's difficult to say. I think it's difficult to say that he must have been loving or anything like that.
Yeah, I'm not saying that he wasn't.
No, it's. I would say maybe the all powerful part of that you have in Christianity mostly, that he's. Yeah, and Islam, I'm not sure if Islam has as well. Yeah. I think that aspect is probably the most important part to me, at least. The all. Like, that is where everything would have come from. And that,
would you say all knowledgeable as well? Would you add that? Because.
Yeah, I would probably add that as well. If we speak about an entity, then I would probably say that those two are thing. And the all loving is, to me, I don't necessarily agree with that. But the all knowing and the all.
I would say that all loving is not necessary.
Yeah.
For there to be a universe, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's why I said in the beginning that of all the attributes that we talked about, we can't prove that deductively that God is all loving. That comes from the text.
Yeah.
So ex o facto, if you believe in the text that says God is all loving and that has proof to suggest that, then that's when you can believe that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there's no absolute evidence we can get from a rational perspective to say that God is all loving.
No, exactly.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Having said this, so we've talked about knowledge and basically the ability or God's power, all powerful, you said, part, yeah? Now let me ask you another question. Is it, because if we said that before the universe, right, there was something,
yeah,
and that thing before the universe had qualities like it's all loving and all powerful and stuff, yeah?
Yeah.
If we keep going backwards, yeah, say if we say that there was something before that thing, there was something else before that thing.
Yeah.
And we keep going backwards infinitely, regressively.
Yeah.
Do you not see that that could cause a problem in terms of an infinite regress?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, obviously, but it's paradoxical almost that, like, something has to have created something, and if you go back, something has created that, etc., etc. And I think there's, I don't know, there's no definite answer to that. I mean, that's what all these people are doing. All these people have different views on that, I guess. That's the basis of it, I think. So, as for me, it's something I genuinely don't know. Like, I have thought about it, but it's something that I can accept that we'll probably never know, and I choose to accept it that way. And I
would you say that though? If we go back to that entity that existed before the universe,
yeah,
and we said that in order for the universe to basically exist in the way it does, in order for the universe to exist in the way it exists,
yeah,
you said we talked about power, we talked about knowledge,
yeah,
all powerful, knowledgeable. Would you add to that that entity? I'm not saying it's God.
Yeah,
forget the word God. Yeah. It's not longer in our vocabulary.
I'm cool with that. Yeah.
Right? Think in this thing. And by the way, from an Islamic perspective, because someone might be watching me. And thinking, what's this guy talking about? God as a thing. We can actually call God thing. We're allowed to do that because in Sahih Bukhari, which is our second authoritative like hadith works, God is referred to as Shaykh, which means thing.
Yeah.
So this entity or this thing that came before the universe, it's basically one, all knowledgeable, all, two, all knowledgeable, all powerful. Would you add to that it had to be the first to avoid the paradox of the infinite regress?
Yeah, I can live with that. Yeah.
So, we're sticking with three things here. Just three things, yeah?
First, powerful,
knowledgeable. So, we have an entity that's all powerful or knowledgeable and is the first.
You name it.
Which led rise, which allowed the phenomena of the universe to take place.
It has a high degree of water. Yeah, I can live with that, yeah.
Right. This entity, this thing, which allowed the thing of the universe, the phenomena of the universe to take rise, or to be caused, right? What do you think this entity wants from us?
Sorry?
Why do you think we are here on this planet? What is the purpose of life? Why are we here? Why has this entity done this? The question is why now? Why has this entity done this?
I don't know, I was bored. No,
adaptation is there, yes.
I think it's... I think this entity may have started that. And, okay, seeing that if he's all knowledgeable, he should have known how it ended up. That's fair enough. Well, I'm basically thinking like why not, I guess, if you're all powerful or knowledgeable.
So what's the purpose of life for us as human beings then? What's the relationship we should have with this entity?
Relationship with this entity is probably...
do you reckon we should acknowledge the entity?
In some way, and I think you should respect where we came from and try to explain it as well. Because if we say thing can be anything, can be all knowledgeable, but it could be essentially dust, something like that. Yeah, it doesn't like so you have to explain it in whatever way you want, and I feel like that's, to me, that's most important. Like, if I think it's really important that we try to explain where we came from and we try to delve deeper into who we are and what we're made out of. So
I think that's a very good point. And let me just give you the Islamic narrative, right? Yeah. The Islamic narrative is that we believe that this entity, this thing, it created the universe.
Yeah.
And it's sustaining the universe.
Yeah.
Not only is this the case, that entity is the first, what we call an Awwal. Yeah? It's all powerful. Because he had to have the creative capacity to be able to change the situation in the first instance. And that we don't mean gender, by the way. We just do it because of language. This entity then decided to create a balance in the universe, to put a planet called Earth, to create a planet called Earth within the context of the universe, and to allow human beings to exist in that Earth.
Yeah.
Okay? When the human being now is existing within this Earth, the human being is inbuilt. There's something inbuilt with this human being. We believe it's called the fitra. Fitra, which is an Arabic word, which means the innate predisposition. So it's a predisposition to acknowledge this entity, to realize that this entity exists. our tradition says that basically this this predisposition is inbuilt within the human being. It's quite similar to what Descartes said. By the way, Descartes, I'm not sure if you've read this philosopher before, he wrote a book called The Meditations. And inside of, in the book, in The Meditations, he said that all of us have the signature of God.
Oh, right, yeah. I've heard that. Yeah.
Well, this is a very quite similar concept, because he's a rationalist as well. He said that all of us have the signature. What he means by that is the same thing as we mean by that God allowed the human beings to fathom who he is, and to we would go further and say that the human being submits to his will, to God's will. He then sends messengers and prophets aforetime with one simple message, which is to believe in a one God and to worship a one God. Okay? So we believe that the first human being to ever be on this earth had that message.
Yeah.
And we believe that that message was continued to other prophets and messengers, and that that message was elaborated upon to all different communities. Mm-hmm. Okay? And so we believe in prophets like Jesus, Moses, and Abraham. We say that the final prophet is Prophet Muhammad. Mm-hmm. And whereas all of those other prophets were sent to their people in their time, Prophet Muhammad was sent to the whole of humankind.
Yeah.
So this is our narrative. What are your initial thoughts of that narrative?
I wonder why it's limited. So I wonder why it's limited to that the imprint is just made on humans and not on species in general.
Right, is. So we would say it's not limited, actually.
Yeah, it's limited. Like animals have it as well.
In fact, we have a verse in the Quran, in chapter number 3 of the Quran, where it says that everything in the universe is basically submitting to his will, tawan aw karha, either willingly or unwillingly.
Yeah.
So in other words, the laws of physics that we observe in the universe, which we can actually sometimes digitize and codify, these laws of physics are God's laws of physics. He created them, you know, he made the laws of physics. And this means that all of the things that are happening in the universe are in accordance with the will of God, and nothing can come outside of that will. You see what I mean?
I see what you mean. Yeah.
Right, so we say there's two things, right? And that the messengers, all of them, they came with two primary things. They came with a message and they came with a miracle. So the message is always the same: to believe in a one God and to worship one God. Why believe in one God? Because that is what you're meant to realize, where you came from, your origins, right? Why worship one God? Because that's what everything else in creation is doing.
Yeah.
Everything else in creation is in submission to God. Therefore, Muslims say that it makes sense for human beings to fall within that parameter and to basically be in line with all the other things in the universe. You see, therefore the purpose of life, to be one with nature, right, if you will, is do what nature is doing, which is submitting to the will of the creator of nature. Do you see the narrative here?
Yeah, I see it. Yeah.
So, do you reckon that this is coherent so far? Does it make sense, like, where I'm coming from?
I understand where you're coming from, yes. I see the point. I am not sure about the first people that had the message, like you say, Jesus, Abraham, etc., etc., because that makes me think... is that then in contrast with evolution theory for you or not?
It is in contrast.
Yeah.
First of all, I'll be honest with you, right?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of evolution as a theory, we believe that it's, first of all, it's a broad scale theory, and I've spoken about it before. Evolution encompasses what happens microbiologically and macrobiologically.
Yeah.
It's a theory which has been rehashed, really, from the Darwinian period to the post-1960s period, the 1960s period, where you could say genetics or information of microbiology became freely accessible and intermingled amalgamated with the Darwinian theory.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so if we're talking about the whole of Darwinian theory, we don't say that all of it is right and all of it is wrong. We say that those parts which we reject are those parts which are an aberration to the Islamic discourse, which I could say one thing is definitely an aberration. We believe that the first human being was created directly from God. So we believe that Adam is the first human being and that he was created directly by God. That's the same biblical thing. People that we believe in the Bible believe in the same thing. We don't believe, like Christians would believe, We are under no compulsion to believe that the universe is 6,000 years old or 6 days old, as Christian old age creationists believe.
Yeah.
Because in the Quran, the word yawm, which refers to period, could mean any period. So yeah. It could mean 6 billion years.
Yeah.
We know that the universe is 14 billion years.
Yeah.
So in terms of science as a discourse, one thing which is in contrast to science in the Quran, without a shadow of a doubt, is the belief in Adam.
Yeah.
So we would say that that belief is contradictory to popular notions of evolution theory. So that's one thing.
Yeah.
But then I would ask you a question. Since we know, I mean, first of all, David Hume is a popular philosopher that was well known for his criticisms of induction. He outlined what he called the problem of induction. The problem of induction can be summarized as follows. If I go and see 100 swans, and all of them are white, the theory goes that you can't say that all swans are white.
No, exactly.
In the same way, just because we have certain fossils in front of us,
yeah,
we can't assume that we have complete knowledge of the fossil record and of evolution in particular.
Yeah.
So what our knowledge of evolution today is dependent upon the information we have of evolution or of the fossil record and of microbiology.
Yeah, fair enough.
That is subject to change, as it has changed in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing to suggest to us that this is a certain truth, and therefore it doesn't pose an issue for us. Because in the past, in Islamic history, you'll find that there were actual times where we believe in an inception of the universe, yeah? Because in chapter 21, verse 30, it said that the universe came from one. The heavens and the earth were at one point, and then God cleft them asunder.
Yep.
The static state theory, which existed obviously in the pre-1900s, it goes against that. So the Quran went against static state theory,
yeah,
and postulated an inception of the universe at one stage. So Muslims had to accept that. Yeah. Now we know, I mean, now it's been established, science has shown us that there has been an inception.
Yeah.
So We can't depend too much on scientific notions for absolute certain realities. And this is, I've mentioned this point before, but I'll mention it again. This is detailed by someone in his book. He wrote a book called Paradigm Shift. And he said that every once in a while, there's a paradigm shift. And not only does science change, but the framework within which science works, it also changes. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So can you see why, from my angle, it's not a problem to not regard portions of the theory of evolution as a certain reality?
Yeah, I can accept that, yeah.
But I'll tell you something which I personally believe is an evidence, which you can use as an evidence for the Islamic narrative. So the Quran, it makes a series of claims, right? One of the claims it makes is that if this Quran was from other than God, it says in chapter 4, verse 82, وَلَوْ كَانَ مِنْ عَنْدِ غَيْرِ اللَّهِ لَوَجَدْتُ فِيهِ اخْتِلَافًا كَثِيرًا. It was from other than God,
right, yeah,
then they would have found in it many contradictions.
Sorry, what's more?
Yeah, so the Quran postulates,
yeah,
that if this Quran was from other than God,
yeah,
then there would have been in it many contradictions.
Right.
Okay, so that's one challenge that the Quran sets out. It's quite similar to science, ironically enough, since we were just talking about it. Because science is built upon falsification.
Yeah.
So the idea,
one aspect is wrong, the whole theory collapses. Yeah. Yeah.
So the same thing. So the Quran allows the investigator,
uh-huh,
a chance to disprove it.
Yeah.
And this is in line with Enlightenment theory, knowledge, right?
Yeah.
Where you actually, you know, falsification, Karl Popper, what he said about verification, is all these things that came out of the 19th, 20th century. It's quite interesting because there is a parallel between what the Quranic message is and that.
Yeah.
That's one thing. Number two, it says, فَأْتُوا بِسُورَةٍ مِّنْ مِثْلِهِ وَدْعُوا شُهَدَاءَكُمْ مِنْ دُونِ اللَّهِ إِن كُنْتُمْ صَدَقِينَ. If you are, it says, وَإِن كُنْتُمْ فِي رَيْبٍ, if you are in any doubt that this book is from God, then bring one chapter like it and call your witnesses from aside God if you're truthful. So really, the Quran also claims that it's inimitable, that it cannot be imitated in its style and its unique literary approach. In addition to this, the Quran itself, it claims that with the word ayah is like the verse, the equivalent of a verse of the Quran. It claims to be an evidence, a proof. And there are many reasons why we believe that this is the case. One of the reasons is that we say that the Quran itself is a linguistic i'jaz, or which means something which is incapacitating. Linguistically, the Quran, from an Arabic language perspective, does what any does what no other prose can do in Arabic. So it creates an incredible kind of atmosphere, whereby if the listener is listening, he'll be drawn to it and encapsulated by it. So that's another evidence that is put forward. But since we were talking about science, what is quite interesting is that it seems to be that those verses, there's 6,236 verses in the Quran, yeah? Those verses which refer to naturalistic phenomena, if you actually collate them and analyze them, my postulation is that you will not find, yeah, that much disparity between today's scientific explanations and at least one of the interpretations of some of those verses. In other words, I could say something in English, yeah, and it could have two or three different meanings. So you could interpret it in two or three different ways. I'm saying to you that, in my estimation, the Quran, the verses that reference science, there will be at least one interpretation that we can take as 21st century observers, and we will be able to correlate it with what we have discovered. So, and I personally believe this shows you that the Quran is a timeless book. So once again, for example, we were talking about chapter 21, verse 30, about the inception of the universe. And if it's possible, it's not impossible for a human being to make a parallel between today's theory of singularity and inception and that verse in the Quran where it talks about it all coming from a single
Earth.
And certainly, if you continue the verses, it talks about all human beings created from water, which is obviously
similar to what we know.
Yeah, similar to what we know. The revolutions of the Earth, the sun and the moon, which is something we know today, right?
I know.
And many other things. The fact that for example, that there is a verse in chapter 51 of the Quran that talks about the universe expanding, or that the sama is expanding.
Yeah.
Which means the skies above are expanding.
Yeah.
Right. So there are lots of things that we would say are in line with today's discoveries, that they're not disparate from them. I'm not saying that you won't be able to find in the classical exegesis, i.e. the explanations of the book, something which will negate science, because that would be an incredible claim. All of those people that came before time, none of them said anything scientific. That would be an incredible claim and easily disproven. But what I'm saying is that you'll be able to find at least one interpretation that is in line with a lot of what we know. If there are contradictions, there'll be few in number, and I've mentioned one of them to you today. I'm being completely honest. One of the contradictions is the theory of evolution as it relates to the first human being. And had I been lying to you about all the other things, I wouldn't have been able to tell you that quite bluntly, that we don't accept that part of science. If it is science, even though it is a theory, but some scientists know this evolution is evolution. So it's fine. Let it be what it is.
Yeah.
We don't accept it, that part of it. So the point is, I'm saying is, do you not see where we're coming from? So we have a book which we believe is timeless, which is miraculous, and which is, despite it being falsifiable, it's not been falsified.
Yeah.
From that angle, can you see where I'm coming from as a Muslim?
Yeah, I understand. I have to say, I didn't know this extensively about how that all worked, so to speak. But I understand. Yeah, I do understand where you're coming from. I'm wondering, is that much different from what the Bible claims or what Christians claim? Because I don't know enough of both books. I haven't read either the Quran or the Bible, so I wouldn't know. I'm completely trusting what you're telling me.
So that's
why it's difficult for me to make a judgment. But if that is all true, then yes, I completely understand where Muslims come from. Like, I understand why the Muslim religion is such a popular religion. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, right? You talk to me about the Bible. I think making comparisons is pivotal as well, right? Because both of these religions are ancient religions.
Right? Yeah.
Christianity is an ancient religion and Islam is an ancient religion. We're speaking about those two religions in hindsight now. What I was going to say to you is that if you look at the biblical discourse, if you look at those verses, let's just use this naturalistic thing as an example. Those verses that refer to naturalistic phenomena, unlike the Quran where there are multiple ways you can interpret it, and I postulate that at least there will be one way which you could say is in line with what we know today.
Yeah.
That doesn't disregard that there could be a contradiction.
Yeah, yeah.
But what I'm saying about the Bible is that there is such a, in my estimation, and I'll give you examples with references, there is such an incredible disparity between the scientific method and the biblical discourse, that if you were a fan of science, or of someone who believes in that science is a strong way of realizing the environment around you,
yeah,
you couldn't come to terms with the biblical discourse in any way.
Right, right, right. Yeah, I get what you're saying.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. So, for example, Genesis, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the idea that the universe... if you look at Genesis, right?
Mm-hmm.
The sun was created before... the earth was created before the sun.
Okay.
That's the first point. The second point is that the vegetation was created before the sun, but we know now from photosynthesis.
Right. Yeah.
Look, this is just one thing.
Yeah.
And the same thing with the fact of the shape of the earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Flat. Yeah.
So there are lots of examples that we can use, and the pillars of the earth. In Job chapter number 9, verse number 6. So this is complete. I mean, you couldn't try and make a match of any kind of match between the biblical discourse,
right?
And the so the point I'm making to you is, if you really analyze these religious books,
yeah,
you'll find genuinely that you'll find really that the Quran is really the only, despite being 1,400 years old, it has a timeless feature to it.
Right.
It's almost as if it knows what's going on today.
Right.
But we would say the author of that book did know.
Right.
Which is God.
Didn't know. Yeah.
And I'll give you one thing, actually, since I was on that point, and then I'll let you comment on this, because I find it interesting, yeah? You know, in the Quran, chapter number 30 of the Quran is referred to as Surah Rum. Chapter is called Rum, yeah? At the time of the Prophet Muhammad, there were two major empires. There was the Persian Empire and the Roman Empire. Those two empires, it was like a bipolar system, so you had two major superpowers. Those two superpowers were fighting against each other in terms of, trying to win over empire from one another, yeah? Usurp one another's empire. What had happened is that the Romans at one point had been defeated, and this is known in Western historical books, right? The Romans had been defeated by the Persians. The Quran had made a speculative claim. In chapter number 30, verses 1 to 6, it said the Romans had been defeated, Alif Lam Mim, the Romans had been defeated, but in 3 to 9 years that they will defeat the Persians in a very nearby land.
Yeah.
And then on that day, the Muslims will be rejoicing. Okay? Now, if we look at those verses, I mean, if you think about it from a probabilistic perspective, if someone's going to make a future claim, that risk of getting it wrong, if it's a human being.
Yeah.
So when the Prophet Muhammad, if it was the Prophet Muhammad, when he said it was being revealed to him, had he got this wrong, it would have been easy for people to disbelieve in the message. Say, look, you've been completely discredited because you said in 3 to 9 years' time that this empire would triumph over this empire.
Yeah.
This didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore you're wrong, and therefore the whole thing is wrong, and
I get what you're saying, yeah.
Right? So the point I'm making is, since it did materialize in exactly the same way as the Prophet said it would, or that the Quran said rather it would, the question would be then, how could it be like that? From a probabilistic perspective, there are rational evidences, right?
Yeah. Unless you got really lucky, but yeah.
No, that's right. But then you ask another question, because this is one singular example, it's an isolated example.
Yeah.
Genuinely, I think there are so many examples.
Yeah, so what you're saying is essentially that the Quran has been proving right more often than the Bible or any other religious book in that matter.
Well, what it is that the Quran... The thing is
not contradicted, at least.
There's two things. The Quran is not contradicting. I mean, as we said about science, we've had a discussion about science, so it's got a special relationship with science, which makes the person who's reading it able to associate with science and the Quran in a way which is not going to drive the person mad, right? In other words, the Bible is completely disparate from science and completely far away from it, whereas the Quran remains relatively close.
Yeah.
That's point one. Number two, we talked about predictions of the Quran.
Yeah.
So the Quran makes predictions. And I've given you one example, but there are many. Right? So for example, in chapter 48 of the Quran, where it's mentioned that the Prophet Muhammad and his followers will conquer Mecca. Yeah?
Yeah.
And they will do so in a certain way. They'll shave their heads and they'll go in and do pilgrimage, etc.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to go in there, cutting their hair, and they're not going to have any fear. And once again, this could have been contradicted by the reality.
Yeah, but it wasn't.
But it wasn't. And obviously, we have the evidence of that now, because Mecca is a Muslim place, right?
Yeah. Fair enough.
the Prophet himself made a series of prophecies and predictions.
Yeah.
Some of them is like, you know, he predicted globalization. In a hadith that's related reliably upon the Prophet Muhammad, he said that in the future there'll be taqarab al-aswaq, which means putting all of the a closening together of all of the global markets or the markets.
Yeah.
Therefore, I mean, this is one thing.
Yeah.
There is a hadith that talks about cars.
Yeah.
In fact, the word that's used in Arabic is sarj. Now, this word sarj, if you go back to the Arabic, old Arabic dictionaries, and we're not being biased by looking at this new dictionaries, the old Arabic dictionaries that says that these people will be on these cars, and the women will be coming out of those cars, adiyat, kasiyat, that they will wear certain clothes which are revealing, and that they will be dressed and naked at the same time. Otherwise, they'll be wearing very revealing and tight clothes in the future. And people will be moving around, operating in those cars. These are examples of things that in the future the Prophet spoke about that couldn't have ever been known at the time. And he made a series of predictions like this. He said, "Zuya li al-ard." He said in a hadith which is reliably predicted, because we believe, by the way, the Quran and the hadith both come from the angel Gabriel, from God by extension. He said that the earth has been projected for me. فَرَأَيْتُ مَشَارِقَهَا وَمَغَارِبَهَا. He said, I saw its eastern parts and its western parts. Yeah? وَإِنَّ أُمَّتِي سَيَبْلُغُ. He said that certainly my people or my nation, the Muslims, will reach its mulk. They'll own it, basically, those areas. So in other words, there'll be Muslims west part of Arabia and eastward and westward of Saudi Arabia, or what is now known as Saudi Arabia. So this is exactly the kind of spread that did happen. And if you look at the gold map, that's exactly what we've got. But he becomes even more specific. He tells us that Egypt will be taken over by Muslims. It will be a Muslim country. He tells us that Yemen would be. He tells us that Sham would be, which is Syria, Jordan, etc. He tells us that basically that there will be a war between the Muslims and the Turks, which occurred more than one time. He tells us that there will be a war between Muslims and the Indians, which did occur. So he tells us of a list of things that materialized historically, and we would have to ask ourselves the question that if he's saying all of these things, where did he get that information from?
The question is, I do get your point, I understand where you're coming from, but the question is, to some extent I feel that did he predict it and it happened, or did it happen because he predicted it? Because if you say that Muslims follow...
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, self-fulfilling prophecy. If he wrote down, Muslims will go east and west, or I'm not sure if that was what he said, then Muslims reading that say, let's go east and west. If they say, we're going to Egypt, Muslims are sooner to invade Egypt. And same goes with wars, etc., etc. The part about cars, stuff like that, that I'll accept for sure.
Yeah.
It's some would call it strange coincidence, prophecy, whatever, yeah. But the, like... some aspects are self-fulfilling prophecy, I feel. Like,
yeah. Okay, well,
that's at least my argument against that.
I'll say that's a good point, and in fact, it's a valid point.
Yeah.
Right? And we have to be completely honest here. It could be a self-fulfilling prophecy, but there's one aspect of it which can't be. Because you cannot predict that your nation, if it is the Prophet Muhammad, will be able to, through power, be powerful enough to overtake those other places. Or, through other means, we'll be able to physically be a governing force in those countries.
Yeah.
And especially, let me tell you this, especially when it's the case that the Prophet Muhammad himself, in the early days, and most of these predictions were done in his, what he called the Meccan period, where there were literally tens of people that were Muslim.
Yeah.
Can you imagine a band of 30 people, the leader of that band, is telling them, okay, you know, you're gonna be in the Roman Empire, or you're gonna have, you know, the Persian Empire.
Well, I can, because there's. Okay, let's say then that the Islam got lucky, and that's why we now see it as a prophecy. However, there must be tens of hundreds of other religions which have 5 or 10 followers. We say the exact same thing. I'm not saying it is the case, we're saying that could be the case. However, those religions then fell apart, and that's why we no longer know.
Okay, let me tell you one thing which is interesting. If you look at a book called Sahih al-Bukhari, which is the second most authoritative book after the Quran for us, there's a very specific prophecy that is given to someone called Suraqa. Yeah. Now this person, Suraqa, he at the time, listen to when this is exactly the story. It's a very long hadith, so I'm going to give you the abridged version of it. Yeah.
Lovely.
The summarized version. At one point, the Prophet Muhammad lived in Mecca, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
He was trying to go from Mecca to Medina. Medina is a different place in Saudi Arabia. Yeah, I'm not sure if you heard of it. Because he wanted to establish a safe haven there, yeah? When he was in Mecca and he was traveling to Medina, the Meccan chief, the chieftains there, said to him, said that, and put like a warning sign, a wanted sign, sorry, said that if you have this Muhammad ibn Abdullah, Prophet Muhammad, if you catch him, then you'll have a big, basically, money reward, yeah?
Yeah.
So people tried to catch him so that they can get this money reward.
Yeah.
This person, Suraqa, followed him with his, as mentioned in Sahih Bukhari, which is the most authoritative book, for us, the most authoritative history. Suraqa followed the Prophet Muhammad, yeah?
Yeah.
With his horse. He came closer, he narrates that he came closer to the Prophet Muhammad and the horse's legs basically sunk into the sand. So, like, you know, it does happen, right?
Yeah.
He kept doing that because the sand, you know, so he found it quite weird. So he said something in tribal language, which was like, I'll give you, I intend peace, right?
Yeah.
So the Prophet allowed him to come closer. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he said to this person, Suraqa, he said, in the future, so Suraqa was quite surprised, right? Because he said, this can't be the case that, you know, I kept trying to come closer to you, but the horse kept sinking into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So he was so surprised that he said, I testify that you're the messenger of God. Because he claims to be the messenger of God, right?
Yeah.
As he did this, the Prophet Muhammad responded to him. He said to him particularly, specifically, he said, you will handle the treasures of Croesus. You will handle the treasures of Kisra, which is basically the Persian king, yeah?
Yeah.
The Persian leader, the not the monarch, but that was the honorary title for the leader of the Persian Empire at that time, okay? At the time of Umar, which is exactly about, let's say, 16 years after, according to Ibn Kathir in his book Al-Badai al-Nahaya, at the time of this Umar ibn al-Khattab, which is a successor to the Prophet, so the Prophet died, at the time of Umar ibn al-Khattab, there was an expansion to the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
When that expansion happened, there was a war between the Muslims and the Persians, and the Muslims won the war, and the governance changed governance to a Muslim government.
Yeah.
This Suraqa came closer, and Umar ibn al-Khattab, who was the governor at that time, and the leader of the Muslims, he said, come closer to this master Suraqa and handle the treasures that you were told that you were going to be handled.
Yeah.
So in other words, all religions have, you're right, actually, I can testify from reading the Bible myself, that all religions have in them predictions of the future, like, oh, you know, in the future there'll be more earthquakes or natural disasters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In Islam, we have that as well.
Yeah.
In the future, there'll be this. There'll be general trends. But when we talk about very specific prophecies, they aim to defy a probability theory, which would otherwise, like, from a probability theory perspective, it's very difficult to say that kind of level of precision could be found. Can you see what I mean?
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. Yeah, I understand the point. And I feel like, again, in some parts it could still be explained as self-fulfilling prophecy, but that is where the argument of, I feel like that's mostly where the argument of belief comes in, where some people accept that as being so specific that it couldn't have been made by anyone else other than a prophet from God.
You see that 3 to 9 years, for example.
Yeah.
For that to be a very...
I do accept that, yeah.
Yeah.
And... yeah, like I said, some people see that as it being a prophet of God, and other people see that as self-fulfilling prophecy. But I think that there's not going to be one answer to that. But I very much do accept the point that that is odd, and I have to say I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, I think
I'll
tell
you what. I want you to. Can you do me a favor? Because I feel like thrilled to have this conversation with you. Yeah. I'm going to give you my number.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah, obviously off camera so that people don't question or something. Yeah. I'm going to give you my number and I'll send you some information, like just to read the Quran, something like that. Because, look, knowledge is power, right? As Francis Bacon said.
Is it allowed for non-Muslims to read the Quran?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm honestly not sure. I've heard different conflicting stories about that. So
no, absolutely. In fact, we want that to be the case.
We're trying
to spread it because we believe it's true.
Well, my dad has one, so I might then flick it through and show
you. Yeah, no, I'll send you some links. Because we have the internet now. So we go to Quran.com, Quran.com. Yeah? I mean, literally, you'll see the Quran in front of you.
Yeah.
You don't need to read the whole thing. There's 66,236 verses.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll say that just read the message, the core message, the arguments that, because we believe that one of the evidences of Islam are the cogency, is the cogency of the arguments that is presented in each surah.
Mm-hmm.
Right? In each chapter. And really, I'll give you a chance just to look at it, and I'll give you my number so you can ask me any questions that you want. Does that sound all right?
Yeah, cool.
Have you got any questions for me as well?
Not necessarily. I think it's a fascinating subject, religion in general, I feel like many people, at least many Western people, don't know much about Islam, Quran, stuff like that.
That's right.
So that's why it's interesting to like learn. I think I've learned more in the past 10 minutes than in the past 10 years about it.
It's fantastic. Yeah. Listen, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Yeah.
I love it.
And if you need anything, I'll give you my number right now. Yeah?
Sure.
Make sure you subscribe to the channel.